Chapter 38. Creature should, behind a lattice work of pastry. And behold, on the first floor, at the court end of the house, in a room with all the window curtains drawn, a fire piled halfway up the chimney, plates warming before it, wax candles gleaming everywhere, and a table spread for three, with silver and glass enough for 30 John Westlock. Not the old John of Pecksniff's, but a proper gentleman. Looking another and a grander person, with the consciousness of being his own master, and having money in the bank, and yet in some respects the old John too, for he seized Tom Pinch by both his hands the instant he appeared, and fairly hugged him, in his cordial welcome. And this, apostrophe said John, is Mr. Chuzzlewit. I am very glad to see him. Apostrophe apostrophe John had an offhand manner of his own. So they shook hands warmly, and were friends in no time. Stand off a moment, Tom, apostrophe cried the old pupil, laying one hand on each of Mr. Pinch's shoulders, and holding him out at arm's length. Let me look at you. Just the same. Not a bit changed. Apostrophe, why, it's not so very long ago, you know, apostrophe said Tom Pinch, after all. Apostrophe, it seems an age to me, apostrophe cried John. And so it ought to seem to you, you dog. Apostrophe and then he pushed Tom down into the easiest chair, and clapped him on the back so heartily, and so like his old self in their old bedroom at old Pecksniff's, that it was a toss-up with Tom Pinch, whether he should laugh or cry. Laughter won it, and they all three laughed together. I have ordered everything for dinner, that we used to say we'd have, Tom, apostrophe observed John Westlock. No, apostrophe apostrophe said Tom Pinch. Have you? Apostrophe everything. Don't laugh, if you can help it, before the waiters. I couldn't when I was ordering it. It's like a dream. Apostrophe, John was wrong there, because nobody ever dreamed such soup as was put upon the table directly afterwards, or such fish, or such side dishes, or such a top and bottom, or such a course of birds and sweets, or in short anything approaching the reality of that entertainment at 10 and 6 pence a head, exclusive of wines. As to them, the man who can dream such iced champagne, such claret, port, or sherry, had better go to bed and stop there. But perhaps the finest feature of the banquet was, that nobody was half so much amazed by everything as John himself, who in his high delight was constantly bursting into fits of laughter, and then endeavoring to appear preternaturally solemn, lest the waiters should conceive he wasn't used to it. Some of the things they brought him to carve were such outrageous practical jokes, though, that it was impossible to stand it, and when Tom Pinch insisted, in spite of the deferential advice of an attendant, not only on breaking down the outer wall of a raised pie with a tablespoon, but on trying to eat it afterwards, John lost all dignity, and sat behind the gorgeous dish cover at the head of the table, roaring to that extent that he was audible in the kitchen. Nor had he the least objection to laugh at himself, as he demonstrated when they had all three gathered round the fire, and the dessert was on the table, at which period the head waiter inquired with respectful solicitude whether that port, being a light and tawny wine, was suited to his taste, or whether he would wish to try a fruity port with greater body. To this John gravely answered, that he was well satisfied with what he had, which he esteemed, as one might say, a pretty tidy vintage, for which the waiter thanked him and withdrew. And then John told his friends, with a broad grin, that he supposed it was all right, but he didn't know, and went off into a perfect shout. They were very merry and full of enjoyment the whole time, but not the least pleasant part of the festival was when they all three sat about the fire, cracking nuts, drinking wine and talking cheerfully. It happened that Tom Pinch had a word to say to his friend the organist's assistant, and so deserted his warm corner for a few minutes at this season, lest it should grow too late, leaving the other two young men together. They drank his health in his absence, of course, And John Westlock took that opportunity of saying that he had never had even a peevish word with Tom during the whole term of their residence in Mr. Pecksniff's house. This naturally led him to dwell upon Tom's character, and to hint that Mr. Pecksniff understood it pretty well. He only hinted this, and very distantly, knowing that it pained Tom Pinch to have that gentleman disparaged, and thinking it would be as well to leave the new pupil to his own discoveries. "Yes," said Martin. "It's impossible to like Pinch better than I do, or to do greater justice to his good qualities. He is the most willing fellow I ever saw." "He's rather too willing," observed John, who was quick in observation. "It's quite a fault in him." "So it is," said Martin. "Very true. There was a fellow only a week or so ago, a Mr. Tigg, who borrowed all the money he had, on the promise to repay it in a few days. It was but half a sovereign, to be sure, but it's well it was no more, for he'll never see it again." "Poor fellow." Said John, who had been very attentive to these few words. "Perhaps you have not had an opportunity of observing that, in his own pecuniary transactions, Tom's proud."
"You don't say so."
"No, I haven't."
"What do you mean? Won't he borrow?"
John Westlock shook his head. "That's very odd," said Martin, setting down his empty glass. "He's a strange compound, to be sure." "As to receiving money as a gift," resumed John Westlock, "I think he'd die first."
"He's made up of simplicity," said Martin. "Help yourself."
"You, however," pursued John, filling his own glass, and looking at his companion with some curiosity, "who are older than the majority of Mr. Pecksniff's assistants, and have evidently had much more experience, understand him, I have no doubt, and see how liable he is to be imposed upon."
"Certainly," said Martin, stretching out his legs, and holding his wine between his eye and the light.
"Mr. Pecksniff knows that too. So do his daughters."
"Eh?"
John Westlock smiled, but made no answer.
"By the by," said Martin, "that reminds me. What's your opinion of Pecksniff? How did he use you? What do you think of him now?
Coolly, you know, when it's all over."
Asked Pinch, returned the old pupil.
"He knows what my sentiments used to be upon the subject. They are not changed, I assure you."
Said Martin, "I'd rather have them from you."
But Pinch says they are unjust," urged John with a smile.
"Oh, well, then I know what course they take beforehand,"
said Martin, "and therefore you can have no delicacy in speaking plainly. Don't mind me, I beg. I don't like him, I tell you frankly. I am with him because it happens from particular circumstances to suit my convenience. I have some ability, I believe, in that way, and the obligation, if any, will most likely be on his side and not mine. At the lowest mark, the balance will be even, and there'll be no obligation at all. So you may talk to me as if I had no connection with him."
"If you press me to give my opinion," returned John Westlock.
"Yes, I do," said Martin. "You'll oblige me."
Resumed the other, "that he is the most consummate scoundrel on the face of the earth."
Said Martin, as coolly as ever.
"That's rather strong."
"Not stronger than he deserves," said John, "and if he called upon me to express my opinion of him to his face, I would do so in the very same terms, without the least qualification. His treatment of Pinch is in itself enough to justify them,
But when I look back upon the 5 years I passed in that house, and remember the hypocrisy, the knavery, the meannesses, the false pretenses, the lip service of that fellow, and his trading in saintly semblances for the very worst realities. When I remember how often I was the witness of all this, and how often I was made a kind of party to it, by the fact of being there, with him for my teacher, I swear to you, that I almost despise myself. Martin drained his glass, and looked at the fire. I don't mean to say that is a right feeling, pursued John Westlock, because it was no fault of mine, and I can quite understand you, for instance, fully appreciating him, and yet being forced by circumstances to remain there. I tell you simply what my feeling is, and even now, when, as you say, it's all over, and when I have the satisfaction of knowing that he always hated me, and we always quarreled, and I always told him my mind, even now, I feel sorry that I didn't yield to an impulse I often had, as a boy, of running away from him and going abroad. Why abroad? Asked Martin, turning his eyes upon the speaker. In search, replied John Westlock, shrugging his shoulders, of the livelihood I couldn't have earned at home. There would have been something spirited in that. But, come, fill your glass, and let us forget him. As soon as you please, said Martin. In reference to myself and my connection with him, I have only to repeat what I said before. I have taken my own way with him so far, and shall continue to do so, even more than ever. For the fact is, to tell you the truth, that I believe he looks to me to supply his defects, and couldn't afford to lose me. I had a notion of that in first going there. Your health. Thank you, returned young Westlock. Yours. And may the new pupil turn out as well as you can desire. What new pupil? The fortunate youth, born under an auspicious star, returned John Westlock, laughing, whose parents, or guardians, are destined to be hooked by the advertisement. What? Don't you know that he has advertised again? No. Oh, yes. I read it just before dinner in the old newspaper. I know it to be his, having some reason to remember the style. Hush. Here's Pinch. Strange, is it not, that the more he likes Pecksniff, if he can like him better than he does, the greater reason one has to like him? Not a word more, or we shall spoil his whole enjoyment. Tom entered as the words were spoken, with a radiant smile upon his face, and rubbing his hands, more from a sense of delight than because he was cold, for he had been running fast, sat down in his warm corner again, and was as happy as only Tom Pinch could be. There is no other simile that will express his state of mind. And so, he said, when he had gazed at his friend for some time in silent pleasure, so you really are a gentleman at last, John. Well, to be sure. He rejoined good-humoredly. There is no saying what I may turn out, in time. I suppose you wouldn't carry your own box to the mail now? Said Tom Pinch, smiling, although you lost it altogether by not taking it. Wouldn't I? Retorted John. That's all you know about it, Pinch. It must be a very heavy box that I wouldn't carry to get away from Pecksniff's, Tom. Cried Pinch, turning to Martin, I told you so. The great fault in his character is his injustice to Pecksniff. You mustn't mind a word he says on that subject. His prejudice is most extraordinary. The absence of anything like prejudice on Tom's part, you know, said John Westlock, laughing heartily, as he laid his hand on Mr. Pinch's shoulder, is perfectly wonderful. If one man ever had a profound knowledge of another, and saw him in a true light, and in his own proper colors, Tom has that knowledge of Mr. Pecksniff. Apostrophe, why, of course I have, apostrophe, cried Tom. That's exactly what I have so often said to you. If you knew him as well as I do, John, I'd give almost any money to bring that about. You'd admire, respect, and reverence him. You couldn't help it. Oh, how you wounded his feelings when you went away. Apostrophe, apostrophe, if I had known where about his feelings lay, apostrophe, retorted young Westlock, I'd have done my best, Tom, with that end in view, you may depend upon it. But as I couldn't wound him in what he has not, and in what he knows nothing of, except in his ability to probe them to the quick in other people, I am afraid I can lay no claim to your compliment. Apostrophe, Mr. Pinch, being unwilling to protract a discussion which might possibly corrupt Martin, forbore to say anything in reply to this speech. But John Westlock, whom nothing short of an iron gag would have silenced when Mr. Pecksniff's merits were once in question, continued notwithstanding. His feelings. Oh, he's a tender-hearted man. His feelings. Oh, he's a considerate, conscientious, self-examining, moral vagabond, he is. His feelings. Oh. What's the matter, Tom? Apostrophe, Mr. Pinch was by this time erect upon the hearth rug, buttoning his coat with great energy. I can't bear it, apostrophe, said Tom, shaking his head. No. I really cannot. You must excuse me, John. I have a great esteem and friendship for you. I love you very much, and have been perfectly charmed and overjoyed today to find you just the same as ever, but I cannot listen to this. Apostrophe, why, it's my old way, Tom, and you say yourself that you are glad to find me unchanged. Apostrophe, not in this respect, apostrophe, said Tom Pinch. You must excuse me, John. I cannot, really, I will not. It's very wrong. You should be more guarded in your expressions. It was bad enough when you and I used to be alone together, but under existing circumstances, I can't endure it, really. No, I cannot, indeed. Apostrophe, you are quite right. Apostrophe, apostrophe, exclaimed the other, exchanging looks with Martin. And I am quite wrong, Tom. I don't know how the deuce we fell on this unlucky theme. I beg your pardon with all my heart. Apostrophe, you have a free and manly temper, I know, apostrophe, said Pinch, and therefore, your being so ungenerous in this one solitary instance only grieves me the more. It's not my pardon you have to ask, John. You have done me nothing but kindnesses. Apostrophe, well, Pecksniff's pardon then, apostrophe, said young Westlock. Anything, Tom, or anybody. Pecksniff's pardon, will that do? Here. Let us. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.